so much.
So let's say that you had an ideal classroom. You were going to set it up. What would that classroom look like?
I would have it more, you know, be a lot more enriched with, I guess, literature that I maybe chose or novels that I chose. And teachers can do that, but they're under a lot of stress from the district to follow the curriculum that the district sets. But, you know, we can teach the standards, but a lot of younger teachers, you know, are under a lot of pressure from administration to teach what the administration wants, and they mandate a curriculum. But my classroom would look more child-centered, I guess center-based, theme-based, and just, I guess I would, even like in mathematics, I would do more, you know, heterogeneous groups, not necessarily from a textbook, but more, you know, problem-based mathematics, number talks. We call them number talks, where you're talking through and giving ownership to students. But you have to have buy-in from teachers. And I think a lot of times you get just what the administration wants, and it kind of creates discord because people aren't on the same page. So you really need, you know, good buy-in, ownership, you know, from teachers that are clear on what they're doing and why, and hopefully a good administrator that can be open to, you know, listening to the staff and having a democratic process.
On that note, Joe Herman, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. For nearly 9 months, Israel has waged a brutal assault on the people in Gaza, which has caused death and destruction at rates not seen in our lifetimes. It is certain that the official death toll is an undercount. A new report by Save the Children notes that up to 21,000 children remain missing. Quote, many trapped beneath the rubble, detained, buried in unmarked graves, or lost from their families, end quote. The Biden administration's continued political, financial, and military support to the Israeli government makes the U.S. intentionally complicit in the ongoing gross violations of international and U.S. laws and war crimes, including genocide against the Palestinian people. A new episode of Al Jazeera's Fault Lines, The Night Won't End, takes us beyond the headlines and into investigations of the killings of civilians by the Israeli military in Gaza and the role of the United States in the war. We are very grateful to be joined today by independent journalist and Faultlines correspondent Sharif Abdelkoudos to discuss the gut-wrenching documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza. Sharif Abdelkoudos is an independent print and television journalist based in New York and Cairo. He has reported from across the Arab world, including Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Iraq, Bahrain, and Algeria, as well as internationally and across the United States. Sharif received a George Polk Award for his investigation into the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, an Emmy Award for his coverage of the Trump administration's Muslim ban, and an Izzy Award for his coverage of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution. It is my great pleasure to welcome Sharif Abdelkoudos back to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Sharif, I'm going to jump right in here. What this film makes so real for the viewer is that no family in Gaza has been spared the impact of this genocidal war. You and the incredible Faultlines team worked with journalists in Gaza who themselves are being targeted by Israeli occupation forces to record and tell the stories of three families about their devastating losses and what it's been like trying to survive over these many months. Can you talk about that process, which produced these incredible stories and amazing cinematographic images?
Yeah, thank you for having me on. Pretty soon after this Israeli onslaught on Gaza began, we started to think about how we can cover it. As you know, journalists have been banned from entering Gaza since October 7th, international journalists. We did try several ways of gaining access to Gaza on the ground, but as with everyone else, we were denied. But there are incredibly heroic journalists in Gaza who have shouldered the labor of covering this onslaught themselves and have suffered the highest of prices. And we contacted a group called Media Town, which does a lot of work with Al Jazeera. They're a documentary film production crew, and they also do news as well. And we spoke with them and asked them to work with us. They have teams in the north and south of Gaza. And we asked them to find us certain stories that we could cover. Another issue with covering this, which was very difficult, was what to cover. How do you tell the story or tell some stories of this genocidal assault where you have so many horrific things happening? You have the complete destruction of all aspects of society, mass killings of civilians, and the destruction of homes and schools and universities and bakeries. You have, you know, the entire healthcare system destroyed. You have forced starvation. You have flower massacres. You have assassinations. You have journalists being killed, UN workers being killed. How do you tell a story that doesn't minimize or marginalize the totality of what's happening? So we decided to focus in depth on a number of families, and we asked the journalists of Media Town to help us find some cases. And of course, in Gaza, it's not hard to find cases. I can't imagine that there's a single family in Gaza that has not been affected by this war in some horrific way. And so this film is really a tribute to the journalists that we worked with on the ground in Media Town. We also worked with a couple of independent journalists as well. They did all the interviews. They did all the shooting. You know, we would ask them to follow up in reporting, and they did all of that. And it really was unimaginable how they did this, because they are suffering all of the things of the people that they're covering. Nearly all of them have lost family members. The production manager is also a videographer, Hassan Jaber. His daughter was killed in front of him. They were fleeing their home, literally running amid bombardment and shelling. And his daughter, 4-year-old Salma, gets hit in the neck. She somehow kind of runs into his embrace and she dies. His other daughter, Sara, was shot, but the bullet miraculously kind of passed through her jacket and missed her. Hassan himself was shot in the arm. He had to get surgery during this production. Another journalist we worked with lost his wife and child while we were working. And our executive producer, Leila Narayan, was getting in touch with him one day. And he said, you know, and this is a couple of days after his wife and child died. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry that I'm late in getting back to you. And we're talking a few hours. He's not really late. He goes, I'm so sorry I'm late in getting back to you because I'm covering the flower massacre. This is when over 100 Palestinians were killed trying to access aid that had come in Gaza City. How do you even process that? His wife and child were just killed, and now he's covering the flower massacre. And, you know, we've worked with them over a period of months. It was very difficult for them even to send the footage. You know, once they shoot everything, they then have to find some way of getting access and going onto roofs to get internet access and sending us everything. And throughout it all, they're all displaced. Some of them lost their equipment. Their equipment was destroyed, and some of them had to end up shooting on phones. They're all hungry. One of them told us they found a can of beans and they were sharing it amongst 10 people. So these are really heroic journalists and very talented reporters and cinematographers. And I think one thing about this film that we haven't really seen before is this kind of stunning cinematography of Gaza, of what's happening in Gaza. This genocidal assault has been live streamed, and so much of how we see what's happening in Gaza is on our phones and is filmed by phones. But these are slow shots and in-depth stories of families that really take you into the heart of what's happening and kind of give you a glimpse, I would say just a glimpse, of the horror that is this war on Gaza.
Yeah, it's remarkable when you think about just the technology, you know, struggles we go through to do an interview, and yet what they are dealing with there and can produce this kind of footage and stories and reporting. Josh Paul served for 11 years as a director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs at the State Department and was responsible for U.S. defense diplomacy, security assistance, and arms transfers. He publicly resigned from the State Department in October due to his disagreement with the Biden administration's decision to rush lethal military assistance to Israel for use in the densely populated Gaza Strip. Paul speaks in the film about the immense amount of evidence continuing to be revealed daily, showing that war crimes are being committed. Can you discuss some of the evidence that the film exposes?
Yeah, I mean, I think through these three families that we follow, so much of how this war has been prosecuted is told through their stories. And there's a lot of evidence of war crimes within those stories. So, for example, the Salem family undergo two massacres. One is, as with so many families, had to flee their home because it was destroyed. And where they were seeking shelter on December 11th, a massive airstrike hit their building. Over 100 members of their extended family were killed just in that one strike alone. They managed to survive, but they were all injured. And we worked with the nonprofit group Air Wars to investigate this strike in particular. And you have to remember, this strike at the time didn't actually get that much coverage because it was just happening multiple times every day. And this is 100 people from one family being killed. And so Air Wars documented for us to as close a degree as possible all the names of the people who were killed and their relation to each other, and built this kind of like family structure and who was killed. And this shows a pattern of the wiping out of families across generations. And that is part of South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, accusing it of acts of genocide. So, you know, that's kind of not new evidence, but it's an additional case that we show. But this same family then has to move again and find shelter in another building. And just barely over a week later, by this time, Israeli ground troops have encircled the north, and they're in an apartment building with several other families. Israeli tanks and troops begin attacking the building for days. No one is firing back. It's clear that there's civilians inside. On December 19th, an Israeli unit, ground troops, storm the building. They enter several apartments. They begin beating severely and torturing the men and boys and the women. They separate the men and the women. Then they strip the men down to their underwear, put them face down on the ground, and summarily execute at least 11 men. We have a lot of evidence to support this. We have satellite imagery showing Israeli tanks just a block away from the building on that day. We have the testimony of survivors, the women who, while they were separated, they could still see what was happening, and they saw the men be executed, their loved ones right in front of them. And two of the men survived. They were shot and passed out, and they also give testimony. We also got WhatsApp messages. After the soldiers left, the family's trying to get help. And so they are contacting relatives in other countries. One is in Algeria, and trying to get the Red Crescent or someone to come to them. And we got those voice notes and text messages and verified the dates and times of what was being said. And after the Israeli troops withdrew, the next day, residents in the area were able to enter the building and filmed the aftermath. And we have two videos. We only show one because they're so gruesome. But you see the naked bodies just down to their underwear of men killed on the floor. You see the blood and bullet-riddled walls. And you see a glimpse of one of the survivors who we later interview, still alive, surrounded by all these dead bodies. And we also have the next day, the survivors were taken to hospital, and Al Jazeera did a report. And we have that same person's name, Yahya, talking about exactly what happened and giving strikingly similar testimony to what he told us. You see Heba Selim, the main character of the Selim family that we film with, injured, talking about how they executed her husband and her injured children next to her. So we have all this corroborating evidence of a factor of this war that I don't think has been covered deeply enough, because it's so difficult to cover because so many journalists have been killed, but of the arbitrary execution of Palestinian civilians by Israeli ground troops. And we couldn't report on this because we didn't have time or the resources, but we had reports of at least two other cases within that week in that same area of very similar incidents where the men are separated from the women and the men are executed in this way. It seems that there was an Israeli unit marauding as a death squad in the neighborhood in that area. And finally, we also have evidence of the bombing of humanitarian zones, so-called humanitarian zones or safe zones, where Palestinian civilians are forced or ordered by the Israeli military to be displaced and to go to these so-called safe zones. And the Israeli military has repeatedly and frequently bombed these safe zones. And we document one family where they moved from the north to Khan Yunis, and very tragically, the building where they were staying was hit. And this one family, the Al-Ghaf family, the mother is killed, 2-year-old son is killed. And then the 8-year-old son is wounded. And this is another factor of this war. The medical system has been completely decimated by Israeli attacks, by the Israeli blockade. And also, people are unable to leave Gaza easily to seek medical attention. They're trapped. And so this 8-year-old child suffered for 25 days without medicine, without the proper medicine, without proper painkillers. They finally get approval for him to be evacuated to Egypt. And what is so cruel is that most of the time, children who are wounded who get approval, their parents cannot go with them. And so we have a video of this very tearful goodbye of 8-year-old Muhammad asking his father to come with him. His father's crying, and he says, "You go, and I'll try and meet you as soon as I can." And then the boy somehow says, "Don't cry," to his father, who's sobbing. But it was too late by then. His injuries and infection had spread, and he died the next day after he was evacuated. So, I mean, these are just some small pieces of evidence of war crimes that are committed in Gaza that we have very strong corroboration for. And finally, of course, the case of Hind Rajab, which she's become an icon because her voice, the 6-year-old child, was captured in a recording with the Red Crescent, which they later released and was broadcast around the world, pleading for help. And she was killed. And we did a lot of our deepest kind of investigation on that and what exactly transpired. And we can go through some of those details as well.
Yeah, let's loop back to that. But these stories, they exemplify the deliberate targeting of civilian families in places where there were no legitimate military targets. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm SD Chandler, feeling very fortunate to be joined today by multi-award-winning print and television journalist Sharif Abdulkudus, correspondent in the incredible Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, executive produced by Leila Al-Aryan, and an incredible team working remotely with Palestinian journalists, videographers, and an on-ground production team in Gaza investigating Israel's nearly 9-month-long genocidal assault on the people of Gaza using armaments and weaponry supplied by the U.S. Congress and the Biden administrations. Sharif, existing U.S. laws, including the Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act, the Conventional Arms Transfer Policy, and the Leahy laws, which require pre-vetting among other safeguards, are all quite blatantly being subverted. Can you talk about the culture of impunity that exists, undoubtedly because of the long history of U.S. lawmakers ensuring that U.S. law not being applied to Israel, and also your efforts to speak with or get answers to your questions in any way possible from administration officials?
Well, I think the culture of impunity is rampant because, precisely as you say, no one is ever held accountable. The United States never holds Israel to account, and Israel knows this, and so it acts accordingly. This has frustrated even centrist Democrats like Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, when it's a violation of U.S. domestic law. We're not even talking about international humanitarian law. It's a violation of U.S. domestic law to continue to provide arms to a country that is restricting U.S. aid from entering a territory. Israel is clearly restricting aid, including U.S. aid, from entering Gaza. And Van Hollen and others have spoken about this. He called it a war crime in Congress, on the floor of the Senate. And yet, still, Israel has not been held to account. They were asked to provide a letter saying that they will allow humanitarian aid in, and there's absolutely no follow-up. And they do not even hold Israel to account when they kill American citizens. A couple of years ago, you know, we covered the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She's an American citizen. She was killed in broad daylight wearing her press jacket and helmet. There's a lot of video evidence, and we document all of this, and a lot of witness testimony that she was shot with a sniper. And despite this, the State Department again and again says Israel's investigating. Then they come out with their own sort of investigation, which completely adopts the Israeli narrative in contradiction of video evidence and eyewitness testimony. I mean, this is not confined, and this was in the West Bank in Jenin. Just in February, a 17-year-old Palestinian-American teenager with U.S. citizenship was shot dead in the occupied West Bank. His name was Muhammad Ahmad Muhammad Fudur. The month before, a 17-year-old Palestinian-American called Tawfiq Hafiz Al-Jaq was also shot in the West Bank and killed. No one's been held accountable for this. Israel just says they're investigating. And even in this case, when we aired this documentary and with some of the findings about Hind Rajab, the State Department was asked about these findings, which showed like hundreds of bullet holes in the car and other findings. And he just said, we've asked Israel to investigate. Israel says they weren't in the area on that day. There is so much evidence to belie that claim. We have satellite imagery from the day showing Israeli tanks up the road from where Hind Rajab's car and where she was with her family, showing multiple Israeli tanks in the area. We have the testimony, the recorded testimony of two Palestinians, 15-year-old Leanne, on a phone call to the Red Crescent saying, I see an Israeli tank. Then you hear the shots and her screaming. You have the testimony of 6-year-old Hind saying, I see a tank. And the Red Crescent person is asking, is it close? Very close? She says, very, very close. And the Israelis took 3 hours to give approval for an ambulance to reach the area, which they eventually bombed. But they provided a map with an approved route for the ambulance to go. Why would they provide this if there's no Israeli troops in the area? So there's a mountain of evidence to show that just that claim is a lie. And yet the State Department just prevaricates and just says, oh, we've asked Israel to investigate. The Red Cross and the UN are not providing Israel with what it's asking for. So it really does create this culture where Israel can do whatever it wants. Soldiers, as we've seen on TikTok, are broadcasting their war crimes because they know that they won't be held to account for it. And what is so infuriating also is that the standard is so out of balance, where we have all this mountains evidence of war crimes on one side and nothing is done. And yet the mere accusation on the other side, without any evidence, causes action. For example, Israel says that UNRWA has employees who were part of October 7th. No evidence to back this up whatsoever. It's supposedly 12 people out of thousands and thousands of people in UNRWA. What does the U.S. do? Cut off funding to the most important humanitarian organization, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank and for Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Jordan and Syria. Cuts off all the funding on the merest accusation. You have people saying that there were 40 beheaded babies. No evidence whatsoever. It comes out of President Biden's mouth. He says it and says, I saw the photos, even though he didn't. So this disparity in claims and what's credible is so stark and so obvious that it's shameful. And, you know, I don't think the world will ever forget it.
No. And even if you look at the timing of when Israel makes that claim about UNRWA, it comes within hours of the UN putting out their report. And they end up getting exactly what they want. They wanted to shut down UNRWA and create a fake utopia where there are no refugees for years. And the Biden administration just goes along with them. And not only does the U.S. cut off funding to UNRWA, but they get other countries to go along with them. I wonder if in the aftermath of this unbelievable film coming out, have there been any response to you in all the people in the administration that you had reached out to? Are you getting any response to the film?
From the administration, no. I mean, as I mentioned before, the spokesperson at the State Department was asked about some of the findings in one of the cases, and, you know, I blew that off. We asked for a sit-down interview with the State Department or the White House over the course of 4 months. We are the premier current affairs show on Al Jazeera English, and we were denied an interview. They granted interviews to a lot of other outlets, but they unfortunately chose not to engage with us. I went to the White House multiple times and to the State Department multiple times. I was not called on. And so clearly they don't want to answer tough questions. And I think it also speaks to the fact that tough questions are generally not asked by legacy media in this country. And their coverage of this genocidal assault has been atrocious, and it has enabled this genocidal assault to continue in the way it has been covered. And especially on this issue, more than any other, on Palestine, in general, corporate and legacy media follows very closely what establishment orthodoxy is in Washington. And because establishment orthodoxy in Washington is so pro-Israel, that's what we see reflected in the media coverage as well. And for a long time, they have been enablers of Israeli apartheid, of Israeli occupation, and now they've been enablers of Israeli genocide.
That's absolutely right. They're more interested in access than in actually doing their job. Sharif, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and for your work in this incredible, incredible documentary that everybody should see. As Sharif Abdulkudus and Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard say in The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, according to the United Nations, it could take 80 years to rebuild Gaza. But the war hasn't just destroyed Gaza. It has upended the system of international laws that was supposed to prevent these types of atrocities from happening. The rules that were supposed to bind us together to prevent the worst from happening, to prevent us from committing the worst on others, because we are capable of doing it. Those rules are no longer applicable. And once you justify the violations of those rules, you are basically saying the rules are no longer applicable. And everything we created after World War II is up for rewriting. And it will not just be the United States and their allies who are going to do that. They have opened the door to hell. Once again, I want to thank our guest, award-winning print and television journalist, Sharif Abdulkudus, correspondent in the incredible Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza. I also want to thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Felipe. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esti Chandler, thanking you for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.